On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we review our 26 and under power rankings now that we have revealed all 30 teams standing across the league. Talk about our process, which teams stood out, which teams we thought were too high, too low, all the ins and outs of that project. Then we open up the mailbag, read some emails about the ABS challenge system, the Four Nations hockey tournament, and a few other fun topics before we conclude with the good, the bad, and the ugly on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks spring training should actually be 4 months. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And I need high stakes baseball like I need a third cup of coffee.
Yeah, we're already dragging here. But folks, that's not going to stop us from returning to three podcasts a week starting on Monday. The offseason has gone on long enough. Opening day will be here very soon. And on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we're going to open the mailbag because, as we said, spring training is only going to give us so much to talk about. And you fine folks have been giving us some wonderful emails. We're going to start the show talking about the conclusion of our 26 and under power rankings, which we launched the final part here this Friday, kind of review that process and some of the biggest takeaways from our third year doing that exercise. And of course, it is Friday, so we got the good, the bad, and the ugly. Don't you worry. Don't you? Well, we wouldn't forget about the ugly. Okay. That's really why we do this whole thing. Oh, the whole point of this podcast is to get to the ugly at the end of the week. And I can't wait, as always. But Jake, let us begin with the opener.
We're nerds.
That's right. That's why I'm drinking out of my Fangraphs mug. Which you can see on the YouTube and hear maybe if this microphone is good enough. Jake, you say that because we have been doing this project. We have taken on this challenge, this privilege to rank all 30 Major League Baseball teams by all of their talent, ages 26 and under. This is the third year we have done this project. We came up with it's funny you say we're nerds. This scoring system that we came up with is like the least scientific thing ever. And yet when we shared it with people in baseball, they were like, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Like people who are like working on very advanced models that are, you know, projecting the entire league's future. They're looking at our silly 10-5 scoring system, which we can explain here on the pod for people who haven't seen. They're like, huh, that kind of works well.
I will say I did have one very high ranking, notable baseball front office official tell me that there were flaws with it. Hmm. Yeah. And I said,
they're right.
I said, yep. We're two dudes, an internet connection, and a spreadsheet. You got a whole R&D department. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, what we were leaning on here in this exercise is not just the feedback from people around the industry, but also this is where we like to flex our we know all the players, or like we like to think we do, right? And so that was really what we're leaning on more than any sort of advanced mathematical model. So the way that these rankings worked and the way that we decided to pursue this project is basically we looked at, you know, this time of year, everyone's doing farm system rankings, and we wanted to do something that was a little bit more comprehensive when talking about the concept of young talent. And so by looking at players, all players in the organization, ages 26 and under, that's not just the rookie eligible players. That is players who are maybe already in the big leagues and still have their primes in front of them. And that is the most important part. How many teams have a lot of young players on both sides of the ball whose best years might still are either they're right in them or their best years are still ahead of them? And in most cases, they are under team control for many years. So that is what we strove to create. Do you want to talk about the scoring system a little bit just as to how we achieved that?
I just want to hammer home the ideology about it a little bit more. Like, here's an example. Dalton Rushing, a player that we really like and is going to be really good. So he's 24 years old, right? Top prospect. Pretty much a consensus top 20 prospect in the game, right?
Sure. Like, top 20, top 30 is a Dodgers catching prospect.
Dodgers catching prospect, right? Everyone would be happy to have him, okay? He is influencing the Dodgers rankings on prospect lists. He's 24. Jackson Merrill will turn 22 in April. Okay. He just finished second in the rookie of the year, ninth in MVP, outfielder for the San Diego Padres. Every team right now would rather have Jackson Merrill than Dalton Rushing, right? With all due respect to friend of the show, Dalton Rushing, okay? Production at the big league level is so much more valuable than the idea, than the possibility of production at the big league level, right? As much as we love prospects and we are fascinated by them as a thing, they are less important than the players who are currently playing for the major league team. And the rankings, the prospect rankings, as important and as helpful as they can be, like, they pale in comparison to, they leave out an enormous aspect of it. They leave out the Jackson Merrills of the world.
Yes.
Who are still essentially prospect aged and under team control for a long time, but are no longer prospect eligible. And part of the reason that the team control thing is important is because of the economics of the sport right now, right? So if you have a player who's 22 years old and really good, you are paying them the minimum, basically, which is like $900,000, or I think it's maybe it's 800, it's around there,
yeah,
whatever.
700, you're 800,
paying,
yep.
You're paying them peanuts, right? Mm-hmm. So that means you can, if you want to, go to free agency and go get some help. This is how the Chicago Cubs won the World Series in 2016. All those core players were young and under team control, so they could go out and pay for John Lester, right? That is how you build teams. That is the, you build sustainable winning in that way. So what this exercise is doing is looking at which teams are basically set up the best for sustainable winning young talent moving forward.
Yes. And the two other things I would say about that before we can get into some specific teams is, as we mentioned, there's value in the farm system rankings, but the premise of farm system rankings coming out and being like, oh man, this team is a top five farm, like they have a bright future. It's like, maybe, but it's not as likely as the team that has three really good 25-year-old major leaguers, because they are already way far ahead of the team that has some top prospects. I mean, we don't have to explain the fickle nature of prospects. Just look at the three Jacksons from a year ago, right? You mentioned Jackson Merrill. We mentioned Jackson Churio. We mentioned Jackson Holliday. Now, the Orioles still rank quite favorably on this, but it ain't because of Jackson Holliday. I mean, he helps to still be around and could still be a good major leaguer, but not in the same way that Jackson Merrill is buoying the Padres ranking or Jackson Churio is buoying the Brewers ranking. The Orioles just happen to also have Gunnar Henderson and Jordan Westberg and Colton Cowser and all these other guys that are helping their rankings, because if they were leaning entirely on Jackson Holliday, the Orioles probably would have gone down compared to their number one ranking last year, right? Jackson Holliday, a year ago, we were like, oh man, like, even though he's a prospect, this is one of the guys you're really banking on. So I think that's really the main purpose. And so when we reference our non-scientific scoring system, the way we did this, we scored every team by four different categories: young major league hitting, young major league pitching, prospect hitting, prospect pitching. And for the young major leaguers, yeah,
we should have added a fifth category, which is dog. Like, does this org have the dog in it?
Do they have that dog? Yeah, would we have done that? Out of 10, out of 5, out of 100? Yeah,
out of 100. Like, I mean, it just players don't matter. I mean, do you have the dog in you? That's all.
Yeah. Well, again, and we could have, you know, again, should we have added a developmental track record? That would have been kind of amorphous, but we sort of adjusted for that as we've done this. But the point is, the major league categories, we score teams up to 10, and the prospect, we score teams up to 5. And so that was our way to kind of artificially give teams with young, good major leaguers the opportunity to score higher. And that is how we ended up with what we believe is a little bit more of a balanced look at these teams. Now, at the same time, when you look at the total scores across the league, it's not a huge variance between the team at the top, because with the scoring system, the most you could score is 30, and the teams at the top scored 20. So it's not like we had teams nearly maxing out every category, because that's just, baseball's hard, and almost every team has at least one flaw in their you know, in this scoring system. And to me, that was one of the most fun parts of this, to be honest, is that every single team, there was at least one category where you were like, well, I don't know. And that is a reminder of how hard development is at the major league level in particular. So let's get into it. I know we introduced the program or the project a couple weeks ago, but now that we have arrived at the top 10, let's talk about some of these teams at the top. We ended up putting the Boston Red Sox at number one. They jump up from number 12, and that's a team, of course, you are going to see at or near the top of a lot of farm system rankings. But for Boston, I think is pretty simple. The reason they ended up getting all the way up to this part of the rankings at the very top is trading for 25-year-old lefty Garrett Crochet, who is someone that can skew the rankings in a very big way. And when you also have young major leaguers like Tristan Casas, like Willy Abreu, and, you know, a perfect score in the prospect hitting category, as most people who follow prospects already know, That's going to get you up to the top of these rankings. They were one of the most balanced groups.
I also think for the Red Sox, their trio of hitting prospects in Marcelo Meyer, Christian Campbell, and Roman Anthony, like that group is so unique because of their proximity to the big leagues and the likeliness of impact amongst that group. Consensus, really, amongst evaluators, that people are a little bit more split on Meyer. But as far as Anthony and Campbell go, like both those guys are top 10 in essentially every list, right? And so, and they're both probably going to be in the big leagues this season. And we just felt like that group, one of those guys is a perennial all-star. Like one of them is. I feel really strongly that one of them is. I don't know which one because this stuff's hard, right? But that is just so rare. And I think Jet packed them up to the top in my mind. Can we actually go to the bottom?
Sure. Yeah, the bottom is just as interesting in a lot of ways.
I'd actually like to start at the bottom and we can go back to the top. Just because it's such a fascinating quintet down there. Phillies at 30, Rockies at 29, White Sox at 28, Marlins at 27, Yankees at 26. You have these two perennial contenders in the Phillies and Yankees bookending the three worst teams.
Yeah. Marlins and White Sox comfortably. And then obviously by most projection systems, the Rockies are in that bottom three as well.
And it's just, I'm fascinated by that. The Phillies are in last because you just look at the roster, there's no children, you know. Now Stott and Marsh barely miss. And this is part of the issue with our cutoff. It's arbitrary. You have to cut it off somewhere. But it is a reminder, and there are good prospects that the Phillies have, and there is this core of players that exists, but it just gives you a little bit of pause about their future, I think.
Yeah, and that's really where, if we're going to hit one more thing on the bottom, which I think we might have mentioned when we first introduced it, but earlier editions of this list, based on the scores that we had the Yankees even lower at 30 or closer to 30. And to me, I ended up flipping the Yankees ahead of these other teams because even though with Luis Gil not counting by a few months, there is so little pitching to speak of, and the top of their farm system right now is a little bit shaky, for them to have three, at least two everyday major league players in Austin Wells and Anthony Volpe is just more than basically all these other teams have to say right now, except for the Rockies with, you know, Tovar and Doyle, or I guess Doyle ages out slightly, but like, I'd rather have that than what the Phillies are really banking on with the top of their farm system. You know, as exciting as Andrew Painter is, as exciting as, you know, Aiden Miller and some of those other guys are, like, I'd rather take the guy that's already doing it in the majors than those guys at this stage. And I think we had to credit the Yankees for that relatively.
You know, the Yankees and Phillies are good in large part because they've spent a lot of money on signing good free agents and retaining good players. That is how these two teams have built this era of winning. It's not that complicated.
And what that means is you forfeit draft picks and you also are trading prospects. You know, that's a way to do that. I mean, Dombrowski's done that for a long time. The Phillies are one of the best teams in baseball, but it does come at a cost to a certain degree. And if anything, this highlights how the Phillies window, while still a very, 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 very good team, is really reliant on those veterans at the middle or back parts of their prime to remain good.
Now, we got a lot of comments about the Marlins, White Sox, and Rockies being down here. Like, oh, these are teams that have youth movements and the future is dark. Yes and no. I think the future for these teams is hazy. It is not proven. Like, they are on
distant.
It's distant. I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, how do you be a good major league team? Have young impact players. That's like most good teams have those things. And the Marlins, White Sox, and Rockies are bad teams in large part because they do not have those things. Now, they have varying levels of good in their farm systems, but they just have such a dearth of big league talent right now that that's where it kind of shines through. After the Yankees at 26, is there anything in kind of this middle chunk from like 25 to 11 that really stands out at you? Any teams you want to talk about?
Yeah, because again, like it's definitely important to see like the scores, the final scores that they ended up with is relevant because especially when we move up to the top of the list, we had six teams end up with a total score of 18. And that means that you could kind of shuffle. We ended up shuffling them in a lot of different orders. And I think that the teams that were most difficult to evaluate are those teams that have one kind of, you know, as I think it is, I've heard this term often referred to as the aircraft carrier, right? It's like, you just got the one guy that's really, really doing all of it, right? And that's teams like the Royals. I mean, if the Royals don't have Bobby Witt Jr., they're last pretty comfortably. If, you know, if the Padres, for example, now the Padres are different because they have Tatis and Merrill. And you know, a year ago, Tatis alone was keeping them pretty high in the rankings. But that's a team, because we're not necessarily valuing prospects at the lower levels, although I know they're rushing their teenagers. That is a thin farm system right now. And they also don't have a lot of young pitching that's major league ready either, that's not relievers. So Tatis and Merrill are carrying them. But if they only have one of those, how high would they be? And then the Mets with Soto. Soto obviously breaks this whole project since he's still 26. I'm honestly looking forward to doing this next year where we don't have to try and figure out how to do Soto again. That will be nice. And then Vlad Jr. is the other one that I believe their extension, like that was a tough one. So we had the Blue Jays young hitting at 8. Now they have a bunch of other guys besides Vlad, but Vlad, you know, didn't come to an extension like the day that we published the Blue Jays ranking. And I think if they had extended him, I might have made them a 9 or a 10 and they maybe jump a couple spots, because then it's like, all right, at the very least, we know they have Vlad forever. But now we can't give them too much credit, because in that case, we know he's probably gone in a year.
Yeah. And that's like the internal gobbledygook we're doing ourselves. I'm trying to think if there are any other teams that kind of
in the middle,
because
I want to
me.
Talk about the top for sure.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, like, where the Cubs and Cardinals are at 16 and 17 next to one another. Cubs at 17, Cardinals at 16. The Cubs farm system is ranked pretty highly. I think we were maybe a little lower on the entirety of what they have in the system, both at the big league level and in the minor league level. And then the Cardinals are just this fascinating, like the Cardinals are so weird, dude.
I mean, I'm excited to talk about them more as we approach season preview territory, but they were a situation where there were few teams. And by the way, this is still true, even projecting forward. There are a few teams that are projected to give as many plate appearances to 26 and under players than the Cardinals. I mean, it is a ton of guys that are going to be getting a ton of run this year. And some of these players might not be good, right? Like the steps back from Jordan Walker and Nolan Gorman last year were very scary, but they're going to get chances to have a mulligan this year. But when you consider Mason Winn and Burleson and both of their catchers, right, Herrera and Pajes, Victor Scott and Ciani in the outfield, like, and there's probably more coming. They're going to start playing Sejacy. They're going to start playing some of these other guys. Like, they're going pretty young here. And so at some point, when you have that many players who are playing every day in the majors, your score is going to reflect it. And then also Mason Wynn's breakout, I think, helps a lot as well.
But the Cardinals being right in the middle, I think at this point next year, they will either be way higher or way lower.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
I think we'll have
either
10th
or they're 23rd, because we're going to learn a lot about this group.
Right. It's like, oh, either this group of young players is good or they are not. Right.
Yep.
And time next year, we will know that. Let's scoot on up to the top 10, because there's a group of teams that's just bunched here together. Nats at 10, Guardians at 9, Pirates at 8, Braves at 7, Brewers at 6, Dodgers at 5 are all scored the same. The Nats were really weird, really tough to do because of where their talent is at in its timeline. So specifically Dylan Cruz and James Wood, both of whom were consensus top 10 prospects last year. Cruz is still prospect eligible. He's like a top 5 guy, basically everywhere you look. Neither of them, Cruz or Wood, have had big league success, sustained big league success. Both were in the bigs last year, showed some good things, not sustained. If they were prospects, I think people would be like, oh, wow, this is coming. But we're in this bizarre middle ground where we've seen them be fine, but not like fully capture it. And so they just fall in this bizarre crevice that is very rare. Now, this time next year, I think we'll have a pretty good idea how good these two dudes are. But the Nationals as a whole, just they feel like they're in this holding pattern where I would have loved to just evaluate them a year ago or a year from now, and not right now.
Yeah, I think that's valid. I think what's interesting to think about with the Nats is with those two guys, like in the world where, so we have them at an 8 in the young major league hitting and a 2 out of 5 in the prospect hitting. Let's say Cruz and Wood this year had yet to debut and were both projected to start in AAA. Their prospect hitting would be a 4 or a 5, right?
A 5.
And we'd probably be probably a 5, right? And then we'd be dropping their young major league hitting to like a 4 or a 5. So they probably would move down in the rankings overall. But this is where we also have to mention, like, all-star shortstop C.J. Abrams. And I know he didn't finish the season awesome, but what him and, like, Luis Garcia had a quietly really good season last year, too. Like, they have other pieces here. And then I think, based on the feedback also, the Nats have a lot of pitchers. They have a lot of pitchers in this group who are, like, again, how many of them are, you know, future, like, hell yeah, starting game one of a playoff series? I think we're still waiting to see. Those guys might be in the minor leagues. But this is a big portion of the rotation, right? Gore, obviously, Mitchell Parker, DJ Hurz is a guy who, at the very least, is going to be a good reliever. I know you're big on Jose Ferrer. He's definitely someone I think a lot of people are going to learn about this year. And so they ended up being a little bit more balanced than we thought. And I felt like the Nationals were a team that were much lower when we started this exercise. And I think we just realized, like, they are the team that we really do want to highlight because they do have young ascending talent in the major leagues that we believe in.
I'm so worried about Abrams as a defender, though. Dude, he was awful at shortstop.
Abrams is one that, again, we'll probably learn a lot here in this upcoming season. But I don't want to discount what he has shown at times.
Let's go to number 8, which is the Pittsburgh Pirates. Man, we wanted to drop them so badly. Like,
so Pirates Guardians was an interesting debate. Pirates in general. I mean, here's the thing. They have more pitching
than basically anybody,
if you combine major leagues and like on the cusp of the major leagues, and when you're obviously going to give them as much credit as possible for Paul Skenes, who is the most valuable pitcher in the sport. You can debate whether he's the best pitcher in the sport, but he's making a whole lot less than Zach Wheeler or some of the other candidates.
Every single team would give their best pitcher up for Paul Skenes right now.
Yes.
And it's not even
correct.
They wouldn't blink.
They wouldn't blink. Exactly. And so you can't give them enough credit for Paul Skenes, but when you also consider in Jared Jones, when you consider Bubba Chandler and Thomas Harrington and so many of these other guys who are already in AAA and succeeding and are going to pitch in the big leagues this year, we wanted to keep going the Pirates, but then when we put the scores in there, we're like, oh my God, are we really going to have the Pirates who have had however many losing seasons in a row? It's like, this is where we had to adjust.
I love what they have, and I have very little faith in the future of the organization. And,
and that made it hard.
Relationship between those two things is just so unique. And that's just because it's been such a catastrophe over there, especially on the hitting side. Like, they have not shown an ability to develop homegrown bats.
And so that's why we had to round down on all their offensive stuff. But to your point, it's like, I don't feel confident in the future. That's why we ended up defaulting to them below a team like Atlanta, below a team like Milwaukee, below a team like the Dodgers. We can get into the top in a little bit. Guardians was close. That one was tough. I think you could argue, obviously, developmentally, maybe Cleveland, I mean, I think in a lot of ways has a stronger track record. We ended up still leaning. We didn't want to move Paul Skenes too far down the list. And so we ended up with them at 8.
Braves, I'm so high on. I mean, they were number 2 last year, number 3.
Yeah, with Acuna.
Number 2.
Two
they had Ronald Acuna. Yeah. They had Acuna and Strider, both of whom got hurt. Strider still eligible. Acuna ages out. Spencer Schwellenbach showed up and was awesome. Michael Harris is still really good. And I'm really high on two of their prospects. Drake Baldwin, who's a catcher, and AJ Smith-Shaver, who's a pitcher. These are just two guys I think are, like, I'm high on them.
And they're ready, right? Proximity is important, and Drake Baldwin was awesome in AAA. So
I don't know if Smith-Shaver is ready quite yet. He's still only 22, and he's been in the big leagues. He didn't start pitching until he was like a high school senior, you know? Yeah. Like, he was like a quarterback. So the Braves I was fascinated by. And then the Brewers is just quantity. Like, the Braves are quality over quantity, and the Brewers are the exact opposite, where it's like they just have a ton of dudes who are 26 and under, and like, they're the Brewers, and like, some of them will probably be pretty
good. And Churio. Right. So like, Churio kind of puts them to the top of this bunch. But Mitchell, Terang, Frelick, Joey Ortiz, like, just an incredible amount of amazing defense. And yes, Caleb Durbin, who is going to be a major leaguer, I think, on opening day with the Milwaukee Brewers, from what we can tell. We'll see
what
role he is in exactly. Oh, right. They're in New York. That's amazing.
Caleb Durbin, homer, top nine off Devin Williams.
Yeah.
There you go. Top five of this group. Dodgers at 5, Reds at 4, Mariners at 3, O's at 2, Red Sox at 1. The Dodgers are so bizarre. Their big league young hitting is just bad. Like, it's not... like, Andy Pages might be okay, but we'll never know.
Pages is decent, but he's not going to get a chance to prove it on this team. And then Haesung Kim is like, we don't know what he is yet. I mean, obviously they believed in him enough to give him $12 million, but we don't know what he is. Again, we like Dalton Rushing. We like Alex Freeland, super underrated. Like, we believe in their development, and they have a million other young pitchers that are in AAA, and now they also have Roki, and Yamamoto is still young enough for this. So that's why they ended up getting up there, because of all the pitching. And by the way, here's another thing. Can I also just say this too? You know who else a lot of teams would love to have? Bobby Miller.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of teams that would love to have Bobby Miller, and he's, you know, their nine starter. So the pitching helped them, and then we defaulted. It's the Dodgers. I don't really feel bad about that at this point, as much as people want to roll their eyes.
You take the Reds and the Mariners, two teams here for
I mean, this was tough. We debated having the Reds above the Mariners, and you know, maybe you could argue that. I think Seattle, even though they graduate George Kirby and Matt Brash from this exercise, the steps forward from Brian Wu and Bryce Miller, and they still have an elite reliever in Munoz. That combination, right? Two above average major league starters and an elite reliever plus Julio. That's going to get you pretty far when we are leaning heavily on major league ability. That is, again, we talk about the balance. There are a lot of teams that have one standout in one of these categories or a couple in one of these categories, but not in the other. Teams like the Mets, teams like the Padres, where you have those key offensive players, but no pitching. The Mariners having at least one elite, you know, player, asset, whatever you want to say, in both categories, that puts them pretty high up on the list.
I will say they were the one team, like when we got feedback from people, where they were like, you might want to put the Mariners a little lower.
Yeah. Yeah. And Cincinnati's another one that we ended up having high, because the same kind of thing. They have Ellie and they have Hunter Green. That's a pretty good place to start, right? It's an interesting debate. Would you rather have Ellie and Hunter Green or Julio and Bryce Miller, Brian Wu, and Andres Munoz? It's an interesting discussion. But you know, with Matt McClain also, that helped, who we really believe in, that helped push him above the Dodgers and into the top five.
And then the Orioles, they have three everyday players under 26. Like, I want to put Gunner, let's just be like, oh, Gunner is an everyday guy. I know that's underselling. Just like,
right.
The number of teams that have three good everyday players under 26 that are like everyday guys on a playoff team is very low.
It's very short.
Very, very low.
Milwaukee is like kind of there. Maybe Arizona, you know. But I mean, Detroit technically did it, but we don't, like, Detroit did make it to the playoffs with the mostly 26 and under guys, but like, we don't actually know how good most of them are besides Riley Green.
Yeah, it's very hard. The Orioles have that. And Gunnar Henderson is a top five player in the world.
Right. So that is why they are there. And they still have more coming, right? I mean, my God, like Basayo, the home run he hit yesterday. Kobe Mayo is still a top 30 prospect that a lot of teams love to have. Bradfield's going to be in AAA this year. Like, there's so much more on the way.
If Jackson Holliday didn't exist, I don't think it would change their rankings.
No,
at all. It wouldn't change it. And that's banana land, because he was the number one prospect in baseball last year.
Exactly. Yeah. Kerstad, right? Kerstad might be awesome, and we just haven't really found out. Like, that's another guy that a lot of teams, we'd be like, there's a version where Kerstad on a lot of other teams got 400 plate appearances last year and had a 120 OPS plus, and he's like a big part of some other team's young MLB hitting category. And instead, he's just like auxiliary.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. He could have just done what Couser did last year somewhere else.
Sure. Yeah, totally. Anyway.
Red Sox. We talked about him.
Red Sox.
We say this a lot on this pod. Justice for Chaim Bloom. Okay? Chaim Bloom, former chief baseball officer of the Boston Red Sox, who drafted or signed most of these prospects that are, you know, pumping this ranking, including the guys who were traded to the White Sox, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was axed at the end of 2023. So he was part of those drafts in 22 and 23. Yeah.
So
I guess not Brady Montgomery. That wasn't him.
Sure.
But that's okay.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I mean, we like, whatever, we've made this point. Other Red Sox people have made this point, but the Crochet thing is a huge deal. And I also don't think we should undersell Casas Abreu Rafaela also. I know Casas dealt with injuries. Rafaela is a super weird player. Him and Bayo are like super X factors for them this year as guys they extended and had very uneven seasons. Rafaela has one of the worst plate discipline profiles I've ever seen, but his physical tools are marvelous. And he was still, I think, technically an average player based on the speed and defense. But yeah, I mean, his OBP is going to have to improve at least a little bit for him to be tenable as a major leaguer.
I dug into him actually this morning. I'm so out.
You're so out.
I'm so out. I don't think he's going to get the amount of run he needs there. Where he needs to go be on a really bad team and just have he's going to have like another bad offensive season and then like a mediocre one. And then I think he could figure it out in the way that like the White Sox let Lucas Giolito be horrible that one year.
Yeah.
Right.
He's really interesting. I don't, again, like they don't have to stress about it because they have all these other guys there. They already obviously have other great hitters, but how he fits in, he could end up being the most expensive, you know, utility player in the league, which is fine. Again, the Red Sox should be able to afford that, and like he can bring value, but he's super interesting. And then Bayo's another one where they, you know, extended, and he was really, really good in the second half, and I still mostly believe in him. So, but yeah, those two are really interesting. But Casas and then Crochet. I mean, Crochet also is kind of a weird inclusion in this because of his career trajectory. And if they don't get an extension done with him, maybe we shouldn't be giving them too much credit, but I think that they will. And I think that they deserve to be number one on our list.
And of course, Alex Bregman is young at heart. Those are our, our 26 and under rankings. Go read them if you want or don't. I mean, it's free country.
Give us a click there. We wrote a lot of words. There are a lot of, yeah. This was a lot of words, folks. So
thanks.
But hopefully an easy and fun read. So check it out. At Yahoo. I think we had fun with it, and we hope you guys enjoyed this conversation. All right, Jake, let's take a break. When we return, it's time to open the mailbag. We'll be right back on Baseball Arbcast.
And welcome back to Baseball Arbcast. Jordan, what is your relationship with your mail delivery person? Like, do you know...
That's a great question. Living here in small town America, I do definitely like recognize, it's like, oh yeah, that's the same person who delivers the mail most of the time. So in that sense, I do have that experience. But you know, it's not like I'm sitting out down there, you know, sitting on my porch waiting to wave to them. So what about you?
I have a relationship with the UPS guy.
Okay. Oh, right. Because that's also, there's a few different categories of how we receive mail. Yeah.
Like the way that we call each other boss, it is the most like code switch is when the UPS guy opens the door and he's like, you know, got this thick New York accent. He goes, here you go, boss. And I'll be like, hey, you have a good one, boss.
You're just like ordering specifically from UPS just so that you could like have that interaction, and
me and Vinny can say hello every other week.
Let's open the mailbag. Let's begin with an email from Chad. baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, by the way. So we had our conversation about the ABS challenge system, and we got a lot of really good emails just kind of responding. But Chad, I think, gave us the take that I really appreciated and kind of we wanted to share. This is from Chad. He says, what's up, Jake and Jordan? Love the pod. Barbacast truly is a great group of guys who have what it takes, and the way you put in the work to get out there and compete every day is inspiring.
Thanks.
Man. During spring training, hearing those words really, really fires me up.
Keeps you going, man.
Anyway, I'm going to condense Chad's email a little bit, but again, this is good. So I think Jake brought up some valid arguments against the challenge system by comparing to the issues we see with other video replay review systems. Using VAR, the soccer replay review, as a particular example, I think significant pauses in action and impact on gameplay itself have been notable downsides. However, I believe a few things make the ABS challenge system a unique case. While VAR creates stoppages and incentivizes a definitely less than fun style of play, ABS challenges have proven to be swift, and if anything, they incentivize umpires to be better by correcting calls they may be missing repeatedly. Although some players have been fairly loose and casual with their challenges during spring training, there would be virtually no incentive for players to challenge calls during the regular season if they aren't reasonably convinced they'll win the challenge. More than that, however, I think we may be overlooking how the challenge system may actually add to MLB's entertainment value for one primary reason: the players themselves initiate the challenges. As far as I know, referees initiate VAR, and coaches, managers may challenge plays in the NBA, NFL, and MLB. There is very little that is compelling about these systems beyond ensuring the right call is made. But when players themselves initiate the challenge, I am compelled by a variety of scenarios. A player like Juan Soto is an obvious candidate, who's someone whose greatness we may actually be able to admire even more should he challenge calls to a high rate of success. On the other hand, we may get a look into the unfortunate overconfidence of players who actually suck at discerning the strike zone. How about potential player-umpire rivalries being brought to light? Maybe some pitcher thinks Hunter Wendelstedt is just the worst and challenges him on any borderline call whenever he's behind home plate. Of course, the best answer is ever and always to promote and hire the better umpires. Nevertheless, the potential positives of the ABS challenge system pretty easily outweigh the negatives for me, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Thanks, Chad. Good point.
So I was maybe a little too cranky last time with my ABS take. This is a great point. Like, the players are doing stuff. That's it. The players are doing stuff.
We're learning about the players. We are seeing the players in a new... We are putting them in a situation for us to learn more about them, their skills, how they experience the game, their personalities, their standing within the team, right? Like, there would be so many things that... We're not learning these things during spring training because most teams are just like, whatever, like, I'm not thinking about this because it's not relevant. But in a scenario where strategy becomes involved, where who gets to actually challenge becomes involved, right? That would illuminate things that would be fascinating. I often talk about there are only so many situations where the teams basically have to tell us how they feel about their players. I know that sounds weird. You could say, oh, well, it's who's batting in the lineup, who's starting, who's this, or when they get added to the 40 man. Like, this would be a very specific kind of way that we would learn players' standings within teams. Now, it's possible some managers would be like, I trust all my players. If you think
don't do that.
You know, that Hunter Wendelstedt screwed up, like, go let it be known. But I think that would be fun. And I do think that, again, it is so different than just seeing the manager look to his video replay guy in the tunnel and be like, do I have to challenge this safe alcohol? Like, that wasn't fun at the time, and it still isn't fun. There is one other sport where players do challenge, or at least to my knowledge, and that's cricket.
What about tennis?
And that's also fun. Did you say tennis?
Yeah.
Are they do initiate it. That's not just based on if it's really close. Yeah.
I believe so.
Okay. Because I know, like, in I know, like, in volleyball, like, if the ball's out or not, like, that's based on, like, the coach has to do that. But in cricket, like, when you're trying to challenge whether the ball hit, I'm going to have a tough time explaining this if you don't watch cricket.
I get it.
But
the
point is that there you can challenge in cricket. The coaches are not the ones doing that. The players kind of confer and have to decide within like 5 seconds whether they're challenging something, and then they send it to review. And again, that's interesting because then you see the players take responsibility and sometimes look like fools and sometimes look like geniuses.
I think by the end of spring training, I will be pro ABS. I think I just need to open my mind. I think I need to be presented with new information and have more experience around this thing that scares me, and then I will be okay. But that's okay. That's humanness.
Who's our next email? Thank you, Chad.
Speaking of humanness, our next email is from Jeffrey Brown about Paul DeJong, a human. What's happening, BBQ boys? You may remember last year I sent in a field report from the South Side in which I highlighted Paul DeJong's role in the White Sox as a sign of them not having the best roster. Wasn't meant to be a slight against him. Happy had a role in the show, but now my Nats have signed him and I have no choice to believe this is some kind of sick joke against me personally. It's true, Jeffrey Brown. What are we doing? Signing a guy who can't get on base and we have five prospects fighting for the hot quarter. I'm upset with ownership, with Michael Rizzo using full name because I'm mad. And yeah, I'm mad at Paul DeJong. Oh, you can't blame him for taking a deal to play? Yes, I can. I could do whatever I want. And what I want to do is channel my frustration with this team's lack of ability to develop prospects and lack of desire to spend into a hatred of Paul DeJong personally. Jeff, this is what fandom's all about right here.
True.
This is a manifesto of irrational baseball fandom. Paul DeJong does capture that frustration within this specific fan base of like, just let Trey Lipscomb be bad for 162. Like, if you're not gonna spend money, real money, on auxiliary players to help that young core we talked about earlier, James Wood, CJ Abrams, Dylan Cruz, if you're not gonna spend money to push that team over the top in a significant way, then let the young guys, let the kids play.
Yeah, don't spend money to block the kids. Yeah.
Yeah. That unless said, maybe Paul DeJong is like a whisperer.
Maybe. My beef with this move is that it came in tandem with Amed Rosario. It felt like you could have done just one of those instead of both. That one is weird to me, although I love Jeffrey. Jeff sent some great emails over the last couple of years, so we appreciate him. Although there is some inconsistencies here, because he wants the prospects to fight for the hot corner, but then he's also complaining about the team's ability to develop prospects. Maybe he's saying that's why they can't develop them, because they're blocking them by Paul DeJong. But I'm also not even totally sure who he's talking. I mean, I would love to see Jose Tana play, but like, Brady House is definitely not ready. Trey Lipscomb doesn't seem to be super awesome.
I'm a believer.
And there's not too many other guys, but I can understand a fan of a team in this position rather seeing the younger players than Paul DeJong. That is totally valid, and it's definitely a better argument for the Nats than with the White Sox, where it was like, who are we even talking about that he's actually blocking at this stage? Thank you, Jeff.
I wish I could tell you, Jeffrey, to make you feel better that Paul DeJong is a schmuck, but nice guy.
Yeah, Paul DeJong's a nice guy. Again, I think if they had one of DeJong or Rosario, fine. Both probably not necessary.
Next email is from Avery. Avery says, Yo, Avery. I'm sitting on my couch on this lovely Thursday evening, decided to check out the Four Nations face-off between USA and Canada. I gotta say, pretty lit. Has me thinking, should baseball do this? I know the WBC already exists, but they could do this during the middle of the season. Maybe they could shorten the season a bit and make the break a little longer. Maybe play the tournament before the season, leave the semifinals championship for the break. I don't think the All-Star break is bad, so maybe this doesn't make sense to do. I don't know. What do you guys think? Love, Avery. I will say this. As general dislikers of the All-Star game, baseball's All-Star game is the best All-Star game by a mile, I have to say. Like, Pro Bowl, but. So butt that they play dodgeball now, okay? The NHL one before the Four Nations was so butt that they had to do something else. The basketball one, no one wants to be there, and they're barely trying, I guess, except for Wemby, who seemed like he was trying. Ours is okay. Ours is fine. Now, weaponizing nationalism to get people to care about sports more is sick, dude. It's sick. It's dangerous.
Right. I think,
but it puts eyeballs on the television screen.
I would just say, again, it's like how I, why? You
know, it's how I felt about Top Gun Maverick, where I was like, man, military industrial complex is bad, but this rules.
So what, again, though, as he mentions, like, it's very fair to listen to be like, what are we talking about? Why would this be different than the WBC? And what is, I guess, if you limited it to four countries, which again would be like very much against the spirit and a lot of the fun of the WBC, when you have teams like Nicaragua trying to beat Team Japan, like most of the time, those are bad baseball games. So if there was a way to guarantee that the best players from, okay, if we're making it four nations, the U.S., Japan, Dominican Republic, Venezuela, that's like the simplest answer for just going most prominent major leaguers. But you'd still be leaving out so many players that we would want to see. Actually, you know, here's an idea, Jake. Ready? I think we'd literally just match it country for country. You do the four nations of baseball, and you do the U.S., Canada, Sweden, and Finland. How do you feel about that? Who would win?
Sweden versus Finland and Sesapalo.
Sweden and Finland, yeah, in baseball. Okay, let's just do this. I mean, no reason to change it. Team Canada could still be pretty good. You know, they might have a chance. The rest of the world playing for Sweden and Finland. Otani's playing for Finland.
If you wanted to do four teams, you would do four nations. U.S., Japan, Caribbean and rest of world.
You basically do regional.
You would do
North
Cuba.
America.
You would, yeah. Would we get the Canadians?
Well, yeah, sure. Why? Well, I mean, at this point, if we're lumping people together, sure. I guess.
No, Canada is what rest of world. They're rest of world. You do Cuba, Dominican, Puerto Rico, and then you do Venezuela is then with Korea, Panama, Europe.
Here's the thing. If you just super simplify it. If you just did USA versus world, which there is some precedent in other sports, that would be fun. I mean, the world team would, as we saw, and I know the Team USA was not exactly its best roster in the WBC last time, but it was pretty good. Japan did not need the Dominicans to beat us. but at the same time, that roster would be pretty fun.
As cute as it is watching the Czech Republic, no disrespect to the Czech Republic.
Oh, yeah.
And smaller countries like that. I would way rather watch more games of the best teams playing one another.
Yeah.
I would rather watch the USA play Japan in a three-game set than waste time on Australia, Spain, or whatever.
Yeah. I have had that thought, even though, again,
we like it too.
Hey, you want to say that to Sean Spradling's face?
Okay. Yeah, dude.
No, you don't. All right. Sean, that would be heartbreaking if you told Sean that we were literally only doing USA versus Japan. That would be bad news for him. And it's true. Look, these stories are awesome. We had qualifiers last week. We're going to have more qualifiers coming up. We want baseball to be as global as possible, but I do agree with you. I am totally sympathetic to the sentiment of it would be awesome to see the best versions of the best teams, which has obviously not always been the case for the WBC.
I also think that this email, respectfully, is underrating how sick the last WBC was.
Otani's been my point. Ended 100%,
100%. That had crossover appeal in a legitimate way. Now, the difference is that it wasn't during the middle of the season, but we did have that moment. Nations was awesome and it crossed over into the larger sports consciousness in a great way. That happened a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I guess now, right? That did happen. It's great. I don't think you will ever get the best pitchers in the world to do this. There's no way to do it. There's too much money on the line. You can't. There's no way to incentivize them to do it because the money is just higher than what it is in hockey. And the injury risk is for pitchers. More potentially career changing.
Last thing I'll say on this, and then we'll move on to our final email, is just reminder that the Olympics are maybe a thing that we will talk about that is part of this conversation too, is the Olympics in a few years in Los Angeles. So just a reminder that we will come back around on concepts like this in the not too distant future.
Very quickly here. Last email. This is from Dylan. Legitimate friend of the show, wedding invitee, about our Nick Pavetta
wedding
versus
attendee.
Yeah, he was wedding. There.
He did. You didn't just get invited. I mean, I was there.
This is about our Dick Pavetta versus Nick Pavetta Famoff discussion. Boys, I'm fairly certain that Dick Pavetta is way ahead of Nick Pavetta being known per capita. An overlooked detail in your discussion was that Pavetta, in addition to being a 40-year-old NBA ref, may have entered the consciousness of the non-NBA watcher via internet virality when he and very famous person Charles Barkley raced at the 2007 NBA All-Star Weekend and then kissed. I don't need to read the rest of this email. I think that Dylan is correct. I think that is that simple. Only one of Dick Pavetta or Nick Pavetta has kissed Charles Barkley on television.
That's true. That part is tough to dispute. I know we got some Pavetta defenders. We got an email from Eric from Canada, who was like, listen, this Nick Pavetta, he's one of our Canadian boys. We always remind everybody. But I do think that kissing Charles Barkley on national television is going to be tough to beat. I mean, maybe like Nick Pivetta, like perfect game in the World Series. But other than that, I don't know if there's going to be, the bar is exceptionally high for becoming part of the mainstream, you know, culture discussion. So, yeah. Also, man, that, see, NBA All-Star Weekend used to be pretty lit. that was a long time ago. So maybe that's the key. Bring back Dick Pivetta and bring Nick Pivetta while you're at it. All right. We are going to take a quick break and we return the good, the bad, the ugly. Finish the week. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the end of this episode of this podcast, which is Baseball Barbacast that you are listening to. It is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, and one thing bizarre, wonky from the week that was. You begin, because I said so.
My good this week is Chris Bryant. Oh my goodness. I didn't know it was possible that I would ever put those words in the same sentence again. Chris Bryant hit a home run with a 112 mile per hour exit velocity. His hardest hit ball in any game since 2017, which is an astonishing, depressing, and encouraging statistic.
Yeah.
The Rockies, I just wanted to give them some love, not just because Chris Bryant hit a ball hard for the first time in a long time and seems to be healthy, maybe, hopefully. Rockies are just kicking everyone's ass. They're dominating the Cactus League right now, and the vibes are high at Salt River. So shouts out to the Rocks. I am excited for our NL West preview for me to make the case that they are slightly not as bad as everybody thinks. Chris Bryant,
that's
good.
That's good, man. That's great. Nestor Cortes is my good. Because Nestor Cortes is hanging on, baby. Nestor Cortes, who is now on the Brewers, spoke about the Yankees World Series. This is via Newsweek. Quote, "We were the better team. They can talk whatever they want to talk, but we win game one, which we should have. We lost 2 and 3. We win game 4, and we should have won game 5. Here's why this is good and not bad. It's just the level of irrational baseball confidence that is just inconceivable to me. Nestor Cortes, who gave up the walk-off grand slam to Freddie Freeman, saying that they should have won game one. It's like, yes, you should have won game one, but you did it because you gave up a tank.
Can we interrogate that specific part? I mean, all of this is so funny. But, like, would you, like, if you could follow up, I would probably not do this, but this is our podcast and we're very separate from Nestor Cortes Jr. here. You've talked to Nestor before. I've talked to Nestor. He's a nice guy. Like, when you say you should have won game one, like, what does that mean? Does that mean that you should have pitched better, or does that mean that you shouldn't have been in the game?
Nestor, just following up on that first thing, what do you think went wrong in game one? Like, you, yes, should the Yankees have won game one and game five? Probably, but yeah. Them pooping the bed is part of the story. Like, yeah,
they didn't.
I don't think you can watch the World Series and think you were better. I just don't understand.
No.
One more thing.
Still good.
Nestor, nicknamed famously the Hialeah Kid. I was looking into that. Manny Machado is from Hialeah. Like, how did Nestor get this?
I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know. Nasty Nestor is
yeah.
Although, I don't know, Nestor's such a weird pitcher. I'm really curious to see how he is, how it goes this year, because of how bad it ended last year. You forget that he was fine for like the whole year because the injury didn't happen until really late.
Yeah, but also like pitched through probably bad UCL in the playoffs. Yeah. Like he could just throw a pitch in April and be done.
And that could be GG. Yeah, very possible. Nestor, we wish you the best. All right. That was not bad, though. That was good, just to be clear.
That was good, yeah. That's all good.
Okay. I know some people thought that was a bad quote, but we're putting it good. All right, my bad this week. is baseball broadcast related. The poop game is dead, Jake. It's over. This is tragic stuff. This is heartbreaking, to say the least. What am I talking about, the poop game? Well, the Phillies broadcast, the NBC Sports Philadelphia, their chyron for the score bug for the last several years has essentially included the team's logos as opposed to their abbreviations. And because of that, whenever they played the Pirates of Pittsburgh, whose logo is also a P, at the beginning of the game, and as long as the game was 0-0, the score bug would read poop on TV. It would say poop, and everyone would look and say, ha ha ha, poop. But Jake, for some reason, hopefully not because of the poop game, NBC Sports Philadelphia has changed their score bug to become way more boring and way more traditional. They have abandoned the logos and have gone with the, you know, the three-letter abbreviations. And it's all over, man. There will never be another poop game. I guess I'll hold out hope that in the future, maybe the Pirates broadcast or maybe another version of the Phillies broadcast, we will have this once again. Yeah. But this is just tragic. This sucks. This was something I look forward to every year. Now, it just won't, those Phillies Pirates games just won't really feel quite the same.
They took an Imodium and the poop game is gone. my bad was actually going to be the poop game. So,
sniped.
You know, sniped. So, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to copy and paste the Nestor thing. I'm actually going to say that's bad now.
Oh, okay. So now you're going to undo and then now do your good instead.
That was my bad. So now I'm going to do my good. And my good is the University of Maryland Eastern Shore Hawks.
Oh, hell yeah. I was going to bring this up. Go ahead.
For those of you who are not locked into CAA baseball, Division I. The University of Maryland Eastern Shore Hawks were the worst team in the league last year.
In the country.
In the country.
Well, also the league, but...
also the world. And that is it's because they went 0-48 in 2023. Just couldn't get hot. Just a couple bad bounces.
That's true.
What do you say?
2024.
They went 2024. Thank you. 0-48. Not what you're looking for. Going 0-48. But they won this week, beating Towson 14-7. They went down 5-0 in the first inning, but they scrapped and battled back. Home runs from Ryan Howe and Ryan Davis. No crying when you got Ryan and Ryan. As the Maryland University of Maryland Eastern Shore Hawks break the schneid. This is good. Good job.
This is great. I think they're going to win, like, I don't want to get too excited. I don't think this will be their only win. I think they got like 5 or 6 in them this year.
Why did they play this game in Hager? This is about to be very Maryland specific. Why did they play this game in Hagerstown when they were playing Towson?
I don't know, but I think it's because Hagerstown has a brand new ballpark, which we should probably visit because that's a place that means a lot to us. Anyway, congrats to the Hawks. Their hashtag is hashtag soar above and beyond.
Their hashtag. Jordan, if they get another win, Hawk 2.
Hawk W2. Will they have a winning streak this year? I guess we'll see. All right. My ugla this week is 7'6" Mamadou Ndiaye showing up to Dodgers camp. Have you ever heard of Mamadou Ndiaye?
Not on my radar.
There are actually like a lot of Mamadou Ndiayes, and I'm not like there are a lot of famous Mamadou Ndiayes, but this one played basketball at UC Irvine. He's 7'6", I think one of the tallest college basketball players of all time. And he's a big Dodgers fan. And he, on his Instagram, I believe he was at game 5 of the World Series, which is pretty cool. But he got to show up to Dodgers camp, and there is a video of him on the mound with Dave Roberts, Dave Roberts kind of showing him like where his foot strike should be for a very large person.
Get a mocap on him.
Yeah, right. And it's as ugly as it gets. But really what this kind of just drove me to just thinking about is like, because we had Wemby throwing the first pitch last year or year ago. Just the concept of extension is so interesting to me, because like you assume that the tall pitchers have the most extension. Extension is basically how far down the mound you release the ball. And it made me think of Sean Gelly. So Sean Gelly, the 6'11" Giants giant right-handed pitcher who is tied with John Roush as the tallest player in Major League history. I was like, oh, well, Sean Gelly, he must have elite extension, right? And it's like only like above average. And I just, there's something really funny to me because when you watch it, you're like, oh man, this guy's like basically handing the ball to the catcher. But really, if you don't have the right mechanics and the right stride, like no, even Sean, 6'11" Sean Gelly, does not have elite extension. He just has normal extension. So, you know, guys like Glasnow, Logan Gilbert, the Diaz brothers, there's other ways to get elite extension, you know, get down the mound. Apparently, it is not as simple as being really tall. So I don't know. Again, we don't have like the TrackMan on Mamadou here. So I don't know exactly if he was really throwing a pitch and what his extension was. But it is always funny to see large humans try to do baseball things. So there you go. Mamadou and
Jordan, for my Ugla, I had you do some homework. Can you describe it? And then I'll tell you why I had you do this.
Let's see. Yes, it is a video of what appears to be the McNeese State basketball team kind of walking in to a kind of like a, you know, rap song. And there seems to be someone who is not on the team rapping along to every word as they walk into the arena.
Okay, so this video went very viral. McNeese State, I learned, is very good this year. Very good. This video went very viral. It is a song, In and Out by Ludfoe, which is like 8 years old, I think. I don't know why. It's great. And the student manager is just like, the aura is incredible. And he's just rapping along and he's feeling himself. Now, why am I talking about this on a baseball show? Jordan, because this gentleman, student manager, his name is Amir Khan.
Oh, man. Amir Khan. I need an Amir Khan. I got Pete Wheeler and Pablo Sanchez behind me. I need an Amir Khan bobblehead. That's Amir Khan, crazy.
A famous, important character in backyard baseball who is, it's funny that this is music related considering that Amir's brother Ahmed always has his headphones on. So it's good to see Amir getting to enjoy some tunes as well. And this just made me happy that Amir Khan went viral.
Do we think that Ahmed is listening to In and Out by, what was it? I don't know the song.
Yeah.
I got to go listen to
that. It's great because it's also like, how many people in the world are named Amir Khan? Like 100,000?
Probably a lot. Yeah. But not the one. The only one that we care about is the one that's probably like the fifth best pitcher in backyard baseball, maybe fourth.
Yeah. But I saw this video. Yeah. I was like, this is hilarious. I want to learn more about this. Oh, his name's Amir Khan.
I think there's also like, there's another Amir Khan that's pretty famous. That's like an MMA fighter. Yeah, there's a boxer named Amir Khan. I remember seeing him. I like this guy more though.
Yeah.
All right. That's it. Our good, our bad, and our ugla.
No more podcasts.
Previously good, bad, a lot of moving some stuff around in this episode, but this was very fun. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz, as always, for making the show possible. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, and everyone have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back on Monday. Three times a week returns next week. We cannot wait. Baseball will be here. Real baseball that counts will be here soon enough. It is almost March. And we are very excited. Thank you all for listening. Have a good weekend. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.